This is an interview with Clifford Decker, formerly director of physical plant at Stony Brook in the years 68 to 73. We are at his home in Gainesville, Florida. On January 29th, 1987. Cliff, tell us where you came from, what your particular position was before you came to Stony Brook.
You don't have to. This is close enough. You don't have to. Go ahead and talk.
I came to Stony Brook from the University of West Virginia, where I had been on the staff of the physical plant in charge of maintenance for their university hospital. This was prior to 1968. In 68, I came to Stony Brook University.
Who was responsible for your coming and who interviewed you for the position?
My contact and the person who interviewed me was Sheldon Ackley.
In Dr. Toll's office.
In Dr. Toll's office. Yeah. I'm not sure his exact title.
Administrative assistant, I think. But you also knew the director of planning or vice president for planning, Wagner?
Yes, Charlie Wagner and I had worked together at the University of West Virginia. He having the same position there as director of planning and research, and I in the physical plant department.
What was your impression of Stony Brook when you first came? Impression of the physical plant itself and the maintenance staff and the relations with the central office in Albany.
I was greatly impressed by the plans that were at that point still in the making. There were, of course, a number of buildings there already, but none of the medical center or anything of that sort had yet been completed. I had very little to do with the actual planning of any of the buildings, although I was aware of what was going on through my contacts with Mr. Wagner.
Right. Was the medical center in the process of being built?
No, it was being built the year that I left, as I recall. Prior to that, we had put up a bunch of temporary buildings to house the first class of medical students.
But was that the South, what's called the South Campus, the Surge buildings?
That would be the same building.
The group of six on the South Campus.
Yeah, there were six of them that were originally put there to house the first class of medical students.
Right. I think the library was actually down in East Setauket in an old...
Yeah, down near the fire engine
That's
house,
right.
as I recall.
That's right.
Next door in back of it somewhere
yeah, right.
was a medical library.
That's right. what can you say about the adequacy of the staffing for maintenance, for the maintenance of the campus, as you found it?
As I found it, it was inadequate, but over 20-some years of being in physical plant work at other universities, this seems to be the general rule rather than something that's unusual. The physical plant never catches up.
Right. Can you describe the nature of the heating system, the electrical system, the water system, in any way?
The heating system, of course, was a central system. with a central boiler house located in the physical plant section of the campus. During my tenure there, all the utilities were put underground. As it is now, it's all underground. Originally, when I first came there in 68, it was not that way. That was one of the projects that was fulfilled during the 5 years I was there, was putting it all underground in, quote, tunnels, which were actually ditches that opened up and then covered over to make tunnels.
With whom in the central office did Stony Brook deal in the field of maintenance? Who supervised or second guessed those of us on the Stony Brook campus?
Got me there, Carl. I don't think I could remember any of the names.
Any of the names?
No. In fact, I had very, very few direct contacts with upper level, if you want to call it that.
Right. Can you say anything about the elevator system and the results of taking the cheapest or lowest bidder, which seemed to be the state policy?
We always seemed to have problems with elevators, but I recall from West Virginia that they had many of the same problems, probably for the very same reasons.
Yes.
I recall a cartoon of when the first astronauts went aloft, the two of them lying on the couch in the module and things, one turning together and saying, "Do you realize this thing was built by the lowest bidder?" And I think sometimes we suffer from that.
Yeah. Did maintenance work involve any care of the grounds and the planting or the ordering of plants?
Yes, the grounds department was part of the physical plant operation while I was there. I don't know whether it was ever separated away from it,
right. But
it was part of the physical plant operation then.
I seem to remember Stony Brook's getting a sizable amount of money for planting and trying to get them at the same time to bring in somebody who had training in handling the planting, and they wouldn't give us the money or the line to take care of to find enable us to find an actual person who was trained.
I believe that must have been after I left Stony Brook. We had a very small group who cut grass and cleaned sidewalks, et cetera, during the winter.
Yeah.
But that was about the extent of the grounds crew then.
No trained person to take
care. I recall, we had no one that was a trained
horticulturist
or anything of that sort, no.
Okay. And as a result, quite a few of the plants died. It was a real waste of money. Stony Brook was an equal opportunity institution. I suppose you had civil service individuals. How did you get your staff? How
the
did you
only
appoint
it? Civil service employees as such, as I recall, now I may be wrong, but as I recall, the only civil service employees were boiler house type individuals, men who tended the boilers and the heating and cooling systems. The rest were hired off the street.
And you couldn't do that?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I see.
But the others, well, they were licensed, let's say, by the state, licensed to boiler plant operators and engineers.
I see. What about the quality of the equipment?
They were in the process of upgrading that when I left, too.
They were.
At the point where I left, the original equipment was reaching its limit of capacity, and therefore they were having to increase the capacity of the present boiler, that present boiler house, or go to individual heating systems and buildings as they were constructed. And I believe there were a couple coming on that had their own systems. Now, I'm not sure of that either.
Right. Remember, there was a chap by the name of Joe something who was a good bowler. And he was in the boiler house, I'm pretty sure. Did you have any connection with the furniture or the equipping of the buildings?
No, only in the sense of providing labor to help tote it in when it would be delivered.
I see.
Like, I remember one year, one set of dorms that were very, very late, and we had to rush to get them furnished for the fall term. And they used everybody that we could find, laborers, skilled carpenters, anybody that would come and work carried furniture, but not procurement.
I think they were trying to avoid tripling.
That was the student discussion at that point in time, was tripling.
Yeah. Did you have any input into the planning for new buildings as they came under discussion?
I recall attending a couple of meetings at different times where new buildings were being discussed, but as to actually sitting down and working with designers and architects and so forth, no. It was, I think, a local level get together.
Yeah. Buildings were usually planned, and along with it, whatever equipment in the way of furniture, or in the case of laboratories, types of laboratories, gas, water, electricity, that sort of thing. The appropriations included not only the appropriation for the building, but for the necessary equipment. Those who did the planning also apparently did the planning for the equipment and supporting facilities. But they didn't ask you much.
No, I personally had very little input into that. What you say is correct.
Yeah.
They came delivered, ready for use, with all the equipment required.
Did you have any connection with Myron Doucette? He was the assistant in the president's office for scientific equipment.
Very, very little. I knew him on a hello, how are you basis, not really on any working basis.
Do you have any impressions of the way the students maintained the dormitories, student life in the dormitories?
That was probably one of the biggest problems that I had while at Stony Brook, was the fact that sometimes it seemed their only purpose in life was to utterly destroy them. It seemed that way, at least. They certainly did not in any way try to care for what was provided for them. Let's put it that way.
Would you say this was a pretty general characteristic of the student body, or a characteristic of a small minority, or half of them? What would you say?
I would say it was probably a majority.
A majority
of them. In other words, some who cared about their surroundings. But for the most part, it seemed to me that their one joy in life in the evening was tearing the place up.
Would you say that they were not housebroken?
Depends on what you describe as housebroken. For one thing, we had two painters who went around doing nothing but painting out nasty graffiti, not cute graffiti, nasty graffiti.
Yeah.
And they did that 5 days a week. That was their full-time job, just as a for instance.
We were educating other people's children.
I'm afraid so.
Yeah. Do you have any impression of the days in the 60s that were the result of our being in Vietnam? Student behavior of any kind?
Well, of course, a lot of their protest was regarding
recruitment?
Recruitment on the campus by various corporations, which they did not consider to be the nicest.
Chemical?
Dow chemical, et cetera, yes.
What about drugs? Come out the island and become a problem at the university in your time?
Yes, they were a problem while I was there. We had a couple of, drug busts while I was there.
Yeah. Did you ever see the brochure prepared by the local Suffolk County police for the particular drug bust in 68, a 6-inch brochure handed out and given to the television and newspaper people?
I don't recall ever having had the opportunity to see that.
Yeah. They got it together. It was quite a production. In general, any recollections of people, individuals with whom you worked, individual students?
I remember one summer hiring about a half a dozen boys. I think Alec Pond sent them down to our office. They were the ringleaders of the dissident students. And they were planning on something they were going to do all over the summer to be ready for the fall term, and they had everything. They had a place to stay in one of the dorms, but they had to have some way to earn some money to feed themselves. So Alex sent them down and asked if we could put them to work. And I remember it was quite an experience for me, because he warned me that these were the kids that were the toughies, quote unquote. So they came down, and I think there were five or six of these young fellows, and they came into my office, and I must say they went through the proper channels. They came in and asked for to see the head of the department the whole way any businessman would do, which kind of surprised me to begin with. And at the time of the interview, I told them that I would put them to work, that they would probably get all kinds of menial jobs, pushing a broom with a custodial force, digging the ditch with the laborers. You know, it could be anything in the way of menial, unskilled labor. But they seemed to be glad to have it because they wanted, as they said, eating money. And during the course of our conversation, the one, and I can't recall his name now, but I remember at the time, he was the one whose name was always in the paper when something happened.
Mitch Cohen?
Mitch Cohen.
Right.
Mitch Cohen says, "Mr. Decker, are you sure that we have these jobs?" He says, "You know, this a lot depends on this." "Yes, Mitch, you have a job." During the course of our conversation, which lasted maybe 20 minutes or so, three or four times he kept coming back, "Are you sure we have a job?" "Yes, Mitch, you have a job." And finally, after about four or five times, I became disgusted. I said, "Look, I told you you had a job. Now you got it. What's your problem?" And his answer floored me. He said, "I'm a senior at Stony Brook. You're the first person in an administrative spot that's ever given me a direct yes." He said, "I had to hear you repeat it." And I thought afterwards, perhaps that was a sign of the times we were living in at that time. Not anything about any other person in the administration, but our society at that time. These kids were looking for someone to tell them yes or no. If the case be no, tell them no.
Yeah.
And they turned out to be fairly decent employees for the summer.
Good.
No problems.
Yeah. While you were there, what individuals stood out in your mind as contributing to the growth of the institution? And the little light comes on.
I can't say that I could pick out any particular individual and say that the he or she was outstanding because I had a limited amount of contact with the people who were doing the long-range planning. When it came down to the point where a building was under consideration, I would sometimes be called into sit-in meetings at Charlie Wagner's office. And my impression at that time was that he and his staff and the department people for whom the building was being planned were a very dedicated bunch of people. They were interested in the welfare of the university and its growth, and were doing all that they could to make the most of what they had available to them in the way of funding and so forth.
What was the impression you had of the funding, the amount of funding available in the late 60s?
At the time I arrived at Stony Brook, money was still free-flowing. Free-flowing for maintenance, free-flowing for construction, free-flowing for everything. The tougher times had not set in yet, and my short tenure there, I enjoyed rather good financial backing, I guess you'd call it. Financially, we were backed. I never seemed to be able to catch up with the lines for necessary individuals in various trades and so forth for the physical plant.
Do you know whether the lines were asked for by the local campus?
I was assured that they were.
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
And they were cut in Albany somewhere.
Somewhere, yeah.
Right.
Somewhere up there.
Up there, right.
This is the end of the interview with Clifford Decker. This is the beginning of an interview with Richard Schmidt, formerly acting president at Stony Brook for a year, following the departure of T. Alexander Pond, Dr. Schmidt was president of the Upstate Medical School in Syracuse and asked to fill in for a year until they could find a successor to Dr. Pond. He was a neurologist and did a splendid job at Stony Brook. Everybody liked him. The interview was taking place at the home of the Deckers in Gainesville, Florida. The date is the morning of January 30th, 87. I want to ask you a few questions about the time that you were acting president at Stony Brook.
All right.
What was your position when you came to Stony Brook?
Well, I had been president of the State University campus in Syracuse, the Upstate Medical Center, which has since changed its name, by the way. It's Health Science Center at Syracuse. It was in April, or I think it was in April. One morning I was in my office early, before the secretarial staff got there or anything else, and I had a direct call from, without going through any secretaries, from Chancellor Wharton. And much to my surprise, he asked me to consider going to Stony Brook as a temporary assignment. Without thinking, I said, of course, which I guess was, I don't know whether I should have done it or shouldn't have done it, but I did it. Didn't even ask my wife at the time whether it would be suitable with her. And it all went on from there, and I physically moved to Stony Brook, effective on the 1st of June.
What year?
That year. That was 1979, wasn't it?
79. How did Chancellor Wharton describe the situation at Stony Brook?
We didn't have much description of it. Most of the time I was familiar in general with it, as one would be for another campus in a state university. He did tell me about the difficulties they had had in the recruitment and identification of a new permanent president, and the division between the within the consul at Stony Brook and between the consul majority and the trustees of the state university, in fairly general terms, and also outlined that he wanted somebody who would not be a candidate for the permanent position, that was about it. Very little beyond that, as I recall.
Did he describe the differences between the council and the trustees?
I became aware of them. I was actually aware in general terms before he called.
I see.
And as you well know, within a university, there's a great deal of, some of it would be classified as gossip, but let's call it news. Instead of that, in the frequent meetings we had in Albany and so forth, this was reviewed a lot of times in hallway conversation, sometimes magnified and sometimes just superficially. But in general terms, I was aware that there was deep division on the campus and that of the division between the consul and of the trustees.
When you got to Stony Brook, what was your impression of the university at the time?
I found it rather deeply divided into camps, and perhaps a bit more hostility, faculty, students, staff than. Let's say one could constructively say that aggressivity and hostility would be normal. One of the biggest impressions that I had, formed almost immediately, was of the exceptionally high quality of groups of faculty who had been recruited, of polarization among different groups, including the students, and of the general rather low esteem for the what I would call the quality of life. There was a great deal of vandalism on the campus on the part of students. There were fairly radical elements for which there was a past reputation, and things which had happened years before were frequently in the gossip mill as, well, this happened yesterday again, one time I guess there had been a drug raid. This kept coming up as it happening
back
every day.
Back in 68.
And that was years before, but you'd hear that it just happened yesterday, and things of that nature. I felt there was a almost a need immediately of a need of trying to bring groups together and of trying to improve on such things as the quality of life, the attention to the meeting the needs of people, not strictly the needs of academic reputation, research, and things of that nature. I had an impression also almost immediately, which was an expansion of prior experience of the great difficulties in operating a campus of that size with strictures in the budgets which were occurring, and particularly by the very excessive pre-audit or external control which took decisions into multiple stage decision-making within state government in Albany.
Right, that was... It was a situation going back to...